From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
Donald Trump took a victory lap and took credit for keeping 800 jobs at Carrier in the United States. And while there is reality show drama over his pick for Secretary of State, the rest of the cabinet is coming into focus. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is Kelly Goff. She's a columnist for The Daily Beast. Welcome, everybody. So on Thursday, Donald Trump held his first public event since election night, a speech at a Carrier furnace plant in Indiana, where he helped negotiate an incentive deal that reversed Carrier's decision to close that plant and send 800 jobs to Mexico. According to press reports, Carrier will get $7 million in tax breaks from the state of Indiana in exchange for staying at least 10 years. Actually, a pretty low price tag as these sorts of economic development deals go, working out to $875 a year per job saved. Indiana, of course, is governed by Vice President-elect Mike Pence. Carrier is a subsidiary of United Technologies, which also owns defense contractors, so it's likely they were more concerned about what President Trump would do with their multi-billion dollar defense contracts than they were with the tax deal. Still, this was a remarkable set piece for Trump, who promised to use his power and his influence to stop companies from sending jobs abroad. So I think a key question is, will he be able to deliver this sort of thing at scale once he is president? Kelly Goff, let's start with you. Were you impressed with this?
Was I impressed with this bit of perfect political theater? look, I think that to your, exactly as you said, it's a great start for Trump in terms of imagery. But what was interesting for me is that the Wall Street Journal was one of the fiercest critics, actually, of this move in their on their op-ed pages this week, because they were making the point that essentially this is, you know, a Band-Aid on a wound that requires major emergency surgery. And in fact, this actually might cause other manufacturing companies to question building plants in the U.S. in the first place. Look, I don't, you know, I have my issues with conservative thought on business in general, but I think 1,000 jobs is a very, 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 very small Band-Aid for the white working class voters who helped put him into office. This one piece of political theater I don't see being a long-term win for them, but I think in terms of media coverage, which he has proven to be, you know, one of the masters of, it was a total win for him.
Rich, Kelly points out this is a fairly unconservative thing. Conservatives have complained for years about the government picking winners and losers in the economy, which is exactly what was done here with giving a specific deal to this specific company for a specific action. Is this something that people on the right should be concerned about, especially since Trump seems to be saying quite openly that this is going to be a model for how he does industrial policy as president?
Yeah, I think they should be concerned about it. First of all, it is obviously an enormous political coup for Donald Trump, and two, a great victory for those 800 workers and their families. And it's more or less what governors around the country do. It's not ideal policymaking. It's not the end of the world either. What was truly extraordinary was Trump standing up there at the Carrier facility saying that he, as president of the United States, is going to threaten and try to impose consequences on any company that is moving any jobs overseas, and that the Republic, basically everyone in the Republican Party approved of this, or at least was silent about it, does speak to the ideological transformation that Trump may be forcing on the party.
Katrina, when I watched this, I saw something actually of an opportunity for the left here, at least in the long run, in that the way Trump talks about business is somewhat different from the way Republicans normally do. He's definitely a pro-business guy, and he's talking about giving them tax cuts and taking away regulation that he says will allow them to create more jobs. But then he adds this component of responsibility, talking basically about one of the key purposes of large companies being to create good jobs for American workers in the United States. And it makes me wonder, if we get a couple of years into his administration and wage growth is not materializing, he's sort of set a premise that's actually helpful for the left to be able to talk about, see, this isn't doing what President Trump said large companies are supposed to be doing in his economy.
No, I mean, to hear a president say corporate America is going to have to understand that we have to take care of our workers also, that's a kind of corporate patriotism that you've heard from people like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, but it's run through a very different media mill, I'll guarantee you that. They're, treated as wild-eyed radicals, but I think it is an opening. I don't think the model is replicable. I agree with Kelly and Rich. I think it was delicious to see the carrier deal standing as an interesting argument against the longstanding Republican economic orthodoxy that government can't have a role to play in creating jobs in the free market. I don't think this is replicable. I think Paul Krugman wrote, you know, we're talking about 1,000 jobs. At that rate, it would take Trump 30 years to save as many jobs as President Obama did with the auto bailout. It'd take him a century to make up for the overall loss of manufacturing jobs. But listen, you celebrate with the 800 families. You hold Trump accountable. But I do think, you know, Bernie Sanders and some others are right in saying that this may well leave hostage. You know, Trump has signaled to other corporations that they can threaten to offshore jobs in exchange for business-friendly tax benefits and incentives, something that has gone on for years between governors and corporations. But this, you know, is what I think Rich proudly attacked the Obama administration for doing, picking winners and losers. So you've got a president who's going to be able to pick winners and losers. Indiana is a very favored state for obvious reasons. So let's step back and agree that, yeah, the role of corporate America is also to take care of its workers and not just its maximizing shareholder values.
Rich, what do you make of that? Is that something that conservatism needs to find a way to accommodate, if not through this specific Trump approach? I feel like one of the things that was impressive about this as a piece of political theater and impressive about Trump's whole campaign was basically his understanding and his laser focus on the idea that what people want is a job that they can support their family with, which sounds obvious, but there's been so much Republican rhetoric about entrepreneurs and allowing people to start small businesses, which most people don't want to do. And on the left, there's been so much talk about government programs to help people as inequality rises. It seems like the question he's asked of, you know, how do we make sure that that jobs can be central to prosperity in the United States requires some answer, even if it's not the specific answer he's putting out.
Yes. And look, as we've talked about this for a year, even though I've never been a Trump fan, there are aspects of Trumpism that I think are important readjustments of Republican attitudes and orthodoxies. And one of them is that the party was way overinvested and for a very long time in the entrepreneurial ideal. And Trump is wrenching it into being the party of workers. And I think that's a very good thing. And the symbolism here could be important because business decisions aren't entirely about profits and the ledger. That's a huge element of it. But there's also a cultural element as well. And Trump's trying to change from the bully pulpit the culture of corporate America in this regard. And that might make a different at the margins. I think it's much more important to come up with a broad agenda that is favorable to manufacturers but doesn't require one threatening individual companies or going in throwing a bunch of tax benefits at individual companies anytime they threaten to send some jobs overseas. And I think that the big approach here from Trump is really to try to create a tight labor market, to do the corporate tax reform, to loosen the regulation, to try to create higher growth. At the same time, you're limiting foreign competition, both from the outsourcing and from immigration. So a growing economy is felt further down the income scale and, more importantly, results in higher wages.
I think part of why this moment was significant in terms of coverage is when you look back 4 years ago, I thought one of Mitt Romney's worst moments was when he said on the campaign trail, you know, if you're a young person, go out there, start a business, borrow the money from your parents if you have to, right? And I was thinking, because a lot of us are in the position who, you know, have had student loans where we were thinking, I wonder how long it would take our parents to stop laughing if we called and said, Mom, Dad, I need $100K to start my own business, right? And it showed that even though Donald Trump and Mitt Romney both came from privilege, this kind of showed the distinction in terms of how comfortable both of them are in terms of relating to people who are working class people and discussing what those needs and wants are. I think that to some degree, one of the things that those of us who were not Trump fans, I was not one, as you know, underestimated about him is I think that being out there on those real estate, doing those real estate deals, he actually got to know how to talk to the construction workers out there working on some of his properties in a way that a Mitt Romney never got comfortable with. And that's why he knew that a moment like this visually was more significant than perhaps some of us would have anticipated. And that's, I just think, speaks to his political skill that some of us didn't give him enough credit for.
But I want to piggyback on that, too, because, you know, people like Bernie Sanders have said they're willing to work with Donald Trump if he's going to support the working class, the infrastructure. But, you know, he ran a campaign that was tough on corporate America. And the symbolism, we've all been talking about symbolism, as he did a victory lap yesterday, his appointee to be Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin laid out a pretty standard trickle-down kind of corporate-friendly, corporate-heavy agenda. So we're going to need to balance this out. There's no question that, as Kelly said, Trump is not Mitt Romney. So that'll be interesting to see how they square that out in other arenas. He's not the 47%er. He's someone who does seem to be comfortable with working people. And he certainly took another whack at conservative orthodoxy in challenging these corporate trade deals. But I think the I have to say, you know, just as one wants to cover the action, not the tweets, I think we need to keep our eyes on what actually rolls out. Because in upshot this morning, it said in the 2 hours that Donald Trump's been flying to Indiana on Thursday to boast that he saved 1,000 jobs and all power to those families and jobs, about 6,000 private sector jobs in the U.S. were probably destroyed. So I think we've all been talking a little bit about around the edges, because you stand with workers, but it can't be a Band-Aid. You got to have a real program. And the industrial policy we're witnessing with Trump may well be, you know, who knows, bait and switch, carrot and stick. United Technologies gets $56 billion in annual revenues from federal contracts. You got a lot of stick there.
Well, let us know what you think about the carrier plant at kcrw.com/LRC, our Facebook page, or message us on Twitter. We're at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, the cabinet. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine. And Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast, is also with us. So Donald Trump had a very public dinner on Tuesday with Mitt Romney and Reince Priebus. They didn't use a private room at Jean Georges. They ate right in the main dining room, drawing seemingly as much attention as possible as part of Trump's overall seemingly purposeful effort to create an immense amount of drama around his yet-to-be-announced pick for Secretary of State. As we tape on Friday, we're no closer to actually knowing who Trump will pick for the job, but we have gotten other important cabinet announcements. Trump will nominate retired General James Mattis to be defense secretary. He's widely respected on both sides of the aisle, but Congress would need to waive a law for him to take the job since he only recently became a civilian. And Trump's economic team will be led by two wealthy businessmen. As Katrina mentioned before the break, Treasury Secretary will be Steven Mnuchin, a former partner at Goldman Sachs, who has also run a mortgage bank and produced films, including Suicide Squad. And Wilbur Ross, a billionaire investor who's focused on heavy industries like steel and coal, will run the Commerce Department. So I want to start with Rich and Katrina on this, because Katrina was mentioning the sort of, you know, standard Republican supply side or partly supply side agenda that Mnuchin was laying out this week. Do these picks honor Donald Trump's promise to drain the swamp, or is this sort of the opposite of what he was indicating that he would do in the campaign? Rich, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think drain the swamp ever meant that he wasn't going to appoint any of his billionaire backers into his cabinet. Drain the swamp is a pleasingly inexact phrase that's been used by people on the right, like Ronald Reagan, and on the left, like Nancy Pelosi. I think it should mean reducing the influence of Washington. So lobbyists are much less important, but you know, this would obviously just be at the margins. So I think it's really a pipe dream to ever really in any true sense drain the swamp. But these are two guys, Mnuchin and Ross, who are committed to Trump's agenda. And that agenda, as we've also discussed over the past year, a lot of it kind of sits uneasily with Trump's populism because it could have been pulled from the playbook of any traditional supply side, corporate oriented Republican over the last 20 years. I will say, though, the Goldman Sachs connection from Mnuchin, he worked there 17 years and his dad did as well, does contradict, at least in spirit, the more lurid populist rhetoric from Donald Trump, who made it sound as though it was the worst thing in the world that Ted Cruz had gotten a loan for a Senate campaign from Goldman Sachs and horrors was actually married, sleeping with a Goldman Sachs banker.
Yeah, I mean, Trump used to lash out at his rallies that they had, declaring the, quote, guys at Goldman Sachs had total control over Ted Cruz, over Hillary Clinton. As someone noted the other day, if Goldman Sachs is the swamp, Trump is putting on waiters. And it's not just Goldman Sachs. I mean, you got not much swamp draining going on. You don't have a team of rivals. You have a team of plutocrats. And confirmed possible Trump nominees, I think you have nine of some two dozen with key ties to the finance industry. Rich is right. You want to reduce the influence of lobbyists. I think you got now 10 or 11 lobbyists for every representative, and that's the big battle. But this certainly doesn't help, and it does expose. Now, do people care? I think the media should care. I think we should scrutinize, not normalize. I think we should hold accountable Mr. Trump to his campaign promises. But, you know, there may be – you got attention here. He's – quote, literally, the imagery, as Kelly said, standing with the workers – but the same day, you got Steve Mnuchin laying out this trickle-down corporate-friendly policy. How we balance that, how we assess that, how we give complexity to that is, I think, an important role for the media moving forward.
I'm going to actually be the contrarian and be Miss Optimism on this one, Josh, because this is one of those thank God for small miracles kind of week for me, because I think after this man got elected, I mean, there are those of us who are having very legitimate nightmares about, like, you know, Rudy Giuliani running, you know, the civil rights division of the Justice Department and all sorts of other potential horrors that were not far-fetched at the time, right? So the fact that Rudy Giuliani is in running for Secretary of State is, well, rather laughable, because the only person who I think has probably worse diplomatic skills than Donald Trump would be, I'd say, Rudy Giuliani. But, you know, Mitt Romney being a contender for Secretary of State, I think, is actually a very positive thing. I think he would actually be really good at that job. I know I'm not the only person who thinks so. I think Nikki Haley is ambassador to the United Nations. I don't agree with her on everything, but I will tell you that, you know, as someone who is the daughter of people who grew up in the segregated South, African Americans who grew up in the segregated South, the press conference she led, you know, leading support for taking down the Confederate flag, I actually put that press conference on speakerphone so my mother could listen at her office at work, and it was something that made her very emotional. And, you know, I do have obvious concerns. You know, the idea that John Bolton, I think, is in the running for Secretary of State is you know, should raise a lot of hackles in everyone. But I'd say an even bigger concern for me that hasn't gotten as much coverage as it should is the fact that Michael Flynn is in the running to be National Security Advisor. This is a person who tweeted not that long ago, for the record, fear of Muslims is rational. Yeah. I'd like you to tell me a single person who would be in the running for any major position in any office in the land who, if they tweeted the words fear of Christians is rational. The fact is there isn't one.
I want to pick up on what Kelly said, because I do think Nikki Haley is a surprising, interesting appointment. Okay. But I have to say Jeff Sessions is probably just as frightening as Rudy Giuliani. I mean, this is a man who's dedicated
his life. This is the senator who will be attorney general.
This Alabama senator who has been appointed to be attorney general, who was rejected in the Reagan administration.
For being too extreme.
For being too extreme, which says something. But I do think more broadly, you know, Trump again presented his campaign as a repudiation of failed establishment thinking. It promised to chart a new path forward. And in the case of foreign policy, you got Mitt Romney, maybe Giuliani. Bolton was an architect of the Iraq invasion, which Donald Trump says he was against early and all of that. So I'm just saying we're seeing retreads come back. And I think General Mattis, wild dog, warrior monk, who led the Battle of Fallujah, where they closed off access to get out of the city, they firebombed it. This guy is also, you're putting defense contractors in the role of Secretary of Defense, National Security. These are people who are on the boards. Flynn is, I'm sorry, Mattis is on the board of, I think, General Dynamics. And you got the whole issue, which Rich may fully disagree with, about civilian control of the military. I think sometimes a sober general is wiser than a reckless civilian interventionist, but not when you got a whole pack of them. Whole pack of them, and Flynn is, as Kelly suggested, pretty scary.
Well, so one thing here, and Kelly alluded to this, is that when these picks get announced, I'm doing this sort of opportunity cost analysis of them, which is like, if it wasn't this person, would it be some other worse person instead? And so when I look at Mattis, and because Mattis just retired 3 years ago, the Senate will have to specifically approve an exception so he can
become which may not happen, by the way.
That's right.
Right. But so when I look at Mattis and you know, there's been a lot of praise of him. There are some concerns about him. But the broad thing is that I think Mike Flynn, who is not just in the running, is going to be National Security Advisor, which is a position in the White House that does not require confirmation by the Senate. I think Flynn is sort of a crazy person, and I would like him to have less influence in the administration. And Mattis, who was a general with more stars than Mike Flynn, seems to have very much impressed Donald Trump personally. And part of what I think his value at defense would be is that in time, I think Trump would be more impressed with this 4-star general than with a 3-star general. And Trump might spend less time listening to Mike Flynn if Mattis is around.
You think it's a bromance with Mattis. I'll tell you what they're on the same page about. I think they're all targeting, they're interested in pursuing war against Iran. I'm not kidding. And with the abetting of Congress, which has just passed more sanctions, but I think that's what's in their crosshairs.
Trump said on Thursday that he wants to bring an end to the attempts to topple regimes and overthrow governments. I don't know that he's going to keep that promise, but that is at least what he's saying out loud this week. Rich, do you have thoughts on this?
Well, one, I like the cabinet picks, and most of them, with a couple exceptions, Sessions, AG, Mnuchin, and Ross, who we talked about, would have been picks in a Cruz cabinet. And even those three, you know, Cruz would have had his own conservative backers that would have been unique picks in his cabinet. I think suggesting that Jeff Sessions is some sort of racist is shameful. Those allegations were threadbare 30 years ago. He helped prosecute the Klan in Alabama and shut it down. And
why was he rejected?
Based on threadbare and ridiculous allegations of racism, Arlen Specter voted against him and then subsequently said that he regretted it. And if he's such a hideous racist, presumably there'd be something on his public record during his very public life over the last several decades.
It's interesting what Rich said, you know, that he likes the Trump cabinet. Most of these picks might have been in a Cruz cabinet. So all the talk of whacking at the orthodoxy, whether foreign policy or economic, we'll have to see how that works out if you got a team not so committed to that whacking.
Rich, do you have a theory of what's going on with the Secretary of State stuff?
I think there are a couple things. I really think Trump is genuinely drawn to the option of Mitt Romney at a couple of levels. One, for all Trump's combativeness with any of his critics, he really likes winning them over. And he likes the idea of this guy slamming him now being on his team. He likes the idea of Romney being humbled and humiliated. Some might put it, you know, Romney didn't apologize the way we heard some of the Trump transition wanted him to do. But his statement after that dinner was very self-effacing. And Trump's a TV guy, and appearances matter a lot to him, and he likes the way Mitt Romney looks. He thinks he looks the part.
He looks like the Secretary of State.
Yeah, it's really true. But I think the media coverage of this being down to a two-person race between Romney and Giuliani was always overdone. I always think it was much broader than that. And I think John Bolton has a real chance. And I favor Bolton just on sheer grounds that a Secretary of State should be someone with foreign policy experience of a substantial nature. And that is not true of Romney or Giuliani. And it's very likely there'll be a challenge from abroad. There always is very early on. And this is an area where Trump, we have no idea what his reflexes will really be once he's sitting in that chair. And he needs people with experience.
Just what we used to say about I used to say about Hillary Clinton, there's a difference between experience and judgment. And, you know, Bolton was the architect of probably the worst foreign policy debacle, if not since Vietnam of the 20th century. So that'll be, you know, also it's just hypocrisy. If Trump wanted to take a whack at the foreign policy establishment, he talked about it a lot. You bring in the architect, man.
He was
I think the best headline about this dinner was most awkward Tinder date ever.
Tinder date ever.
On that note, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Kelly Goff, what's on your mind?
I actually want to not do a pet peeve, but give a shout out to Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber. He is one of the most successful producers in the history of the international theater, including Broadway and the West End. And this week, he responded to a really startling report about the lack of diversity in theater, but particularly on the West End. It's something he didn't have to speak out about, but he really challenged his peers and colleagues to do more to make the world of theater more diverse. I'm a fan of the theater, and Josh knows this, that I've secretly begun transitioning into playwriting here in the States. And it's been scary that it's actually less diverse than Wall Street. And so it's really, I want to commend him for having the platform and using it to speak out on this issue.
Rich Lowry.
Mark Lilla, a highly respected intellectual historian at Columbia University, wrote a much commented upon essay in the New York Times arguing that Democrats need to give up on their suffocating commitment to identity politics, which has turned out to be a blind alley. This occasioned a ferocious backlash, including from one of Lilla's colleagues, who accused him of enabling, quote, white supremacy, which pretty much proved Lilla's point that you can't even argue about or discuss the left's approach to race and political correctness without being accused of being a part of the Klan.
So I would ask Rich, I'd ask Rich to check out thenation.com, where we had a forum on Mark Lilla's essay showing that the left is not monolithic. There are those who agreed with Mark Lilla, those who disagreed with him. It is at thenation.com. You know, last month, Oxford Dictionary's designated, quote, post-truth as the word of the year. And it certainly defined this campaign. And we learned just the other day that it was first used in a January 1992 article in The Nation by playwright Steve Tesich, picking up on the power of theater and cultural influence. So I, direct people to come and look at thenation.com. And I think it's a word that is not new. Tesich, the playwright, sought to describe what he called the Watergate syndrome, whereby all the sordid facts revealed by the presidency of Nixon rendered Americans disdainful of uncomfortable truths. I think this is going to be a period moving forward where media is going to have to deal with uncomfortable truths and people. And there has to be more humility on the part of the media. We need to listen. We need to hear. And I ascribe to that and will vow to be a better listener and hearer.
For my rant, on Thursday, after appearing at the Carrier plant, Donald Trump went to Ohio and did a campaign-style rally where he made some very specific promises about bringing manufacturing jobs back to the Rust Belt, reading out statistics about the decline in manufacturing jobs and promising to reverse them. The thing is, soon Donald Trump will be president, and in time, he will either do that or he won't do that. Donald Trump has not always been very interested in facts, but once he's president, facts are going to be interested in him. If he's unable to deliver on his economic promises, I think that his showmanship will have a lot less power to power his popularity. On the other hand, if the economy does well, if wages rise quickly, I think he's likely to be very popular. Soon, it's going to be a matter of Donald Trump's actual performance, which is going to be a significant shift from what we've seen over the last 18 months. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and Kelly Goff. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all. Let's call the whole thing off. Let's call the
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.